you pursuing a natural lifestyle for yourself and your family? Are you concerned about the standard American diet and options available for healthcare? Are you curious about herbs for health or already practice home herbalism? You've come to the right place. My mom, Naomi Kilbrick, is a Christian clinical herbalist and owner of Laura Chi Wellness. She teaches simple ways to live in a more healthy way and to work with plants to promote and restore health. Welcome to the Family Herbalism Podcast.
Welcome back to the Family Herbalism Podcast. Today's topic is going to be a really fun one because we are coming into the holiday season and those with irritable bowel syndrome are inevitably thinking about what they're going to be able to tolerate eating at gatherings that will center around shared meals. And this can be very uncomfortable because if you have IBS, you're most likely going to feel that you have to either choose between making others feel comfortable or yourself, and that's not always an easy decision. It's as straightforward as it might seem. And many of you who perhaps suffer with IBS will then choose to take an enzyme supplement to help you digest the food that you know you shouldn't be eating, or you'll willingly accept that this meal that you really want to enjoy is just going to land you in the bathroom for a while. But what if there was another way? So that's what we'll be talking about today, some other options that we can bring in to help perhaps heal from, perhaps make this experience a little bit easier. But before I get started on today's topic, I do want to give you a little personal update because early in November, I shared an episode called I Picked a Fight with an Avocado, but I haven't said anything since then on how my hand is doing. So just in case some of you are interested, and because I have been working with herbs personally in order to help heal my hand, I thought you might be curious to know how things are going. So in case you haven't listened to the episode, here's the situation in a nutshell. I managed to cut through an avocado seed and into my hand, slicing between my middle and ring finger on my left hand. And it was a pretty deep cut that nicked nerves, and I got 5 stitches. And when I had them removed at the 10-day mark, the edges opened up again, unfortunately. So at that point, I started getting more comfortable with applying herbal remedies directly to the area. I gave myself daily hand baths for several days, applied an herbal salve. I also applied a silver ointment, and I took a tincture to help with the nerve damage. I also ended up applying straight olive oil to the skin all over those fingers because they had started to dry out considerably. So it has now been 6 weeks, and the current status is that there is brand new skin over the wound site, which has not cracked in a week, so I feel it's almost safe enough to put my wedding rings back on. I'll probably be attempting that in the next few days if I can get over the anxiety of having them be stuck on my hand. My tendons do feel very stiff and dry, so that I'm actually unable to fully extend my ring finger. I anticipate adding in some marshmallow, mullein, or Solomon's seal, or maybe all three to help moisten up the tissues along the inside of my finger. But I can type again almost normally now. I can also grip things carefully, though I have developed a habit of holding the last 3 fingers curled up so that I primarily use what I've dubbed as my lobster claw or thumb and forefinger to do things. I'm cautiously practicing the use of all my fingers again, and I am able to use it almost normally. The part that is probably going to take the longest to heal is the nerves. For the first few weeks, my ring finger was constantly in pain, throbbing, stabbing, those sorts of feelings. These actually extended up into my armpit, where if I extended my arm too far or too fast, I would get these shocks going up my ulnar tunnel all the way up to my armpit. And my finger was mostly numb on the palm side of my hand and definitely very sensitive to cold. Today, there is no pain, thankfully, and some feeling has returned. About a quarter of my finger running lengthwise is still numb enough that it feels sort of like touching your foot after it's fallen asleep. It runs from the new scar up to the tip of my finger. I have taken a temporary break from working with herbs to heal it because for a little while between healing from my hand and strengthening my urinary tract and also dealing with a virus, I was taking more than a couple dozen plants in one day, and that just got to be a little bit overwhelming. So I took a little break, but I do intend to continue working with herbs like prickly ash, St. John's wort, and milky oats to hopefully restore full feeling. So it's not done yet, unfortunately, but it has come very far. And I also want to say that my husband has been amazing through all of this because he has been washing dishes since the beginning so that I didn't have to manhandle my hand in the water. We hand wash all of our dishes because we live off-grid, so there is no dishwasher. The dishwasher is the humans. And submerging my hand wasn't even an option until it sealed over the wound, that is. And that really hasn't happened until the past week or two. So he'll wash the dishes and then usually I'll dry them, but I get to take my time doing that so I don't hurt myself. And I am just so grateful that he has the time to be able to do that and that he has chosen to do that so that I can heal a little bit more quickly, hopefully. And so now that I've given you an update on my hand, let's jump into our actual topic for today, which is IBS, or irritable bowel syndrome. I have personally multiple relatives with IBS, and in fact, it's probably the health condition I've been aware of the longest in my life. One of my siblings was born with a sensitivity to dairy, which seemed to be inherited. And that led to alternative milk products and meal adaptations being a normal part of my childhood. Thankfully, there is a lot more awareness of food sensitivities and their impact on digestion, to the point that we now have a plethora of food choices to accommodate, and there seems to be a lot more compassion offered to those who live with digestive conditions. So if you experienced IBS today, if you go to a gathering or a party, you're probably going to be more apt to find options that you can eat without having complications. You're more likely to than, say, 10, 20 or more years ago, where this sort of thing was just poo-pooed. It was not validated, for sure. And yet, when it comes to making the decision about whether or not to have that slice of cheesecake or just a few crackers with cheese off that platter, we're still left with weighing pros and cons. Is it worth it? Maybe a little bit of suffering isn't that bad if you get to enjoy the taste. Today, I would like to talk about what is happening with IBS specifically and how the gut may be improved enough that if this applies to you, you may be able to actually eat some of the foods that are normally triggers without having symptoms. IBS, or irritable bowel syndrome, is not the same thing as inflammatory bowel disease, or IBD. These are often confused with each other because they have such similar names, IBS, IBD. But IBD is a category of illnesses that usually involve breakdown of the digestive tract, as in celiac disease, Crohn's disease, and ulcerative colitis. However, with that said, there is growing evidence that unaddressed IBS can lead to IBD. And that's why it's so important not just to disregard the annoying symptoms of constipation or diarrhea or stomach cramping that results from eating things that don't settle on your stomach. The more that you do that, the more serious the prognosis can become. One article that I found entitled "Irritable Bowel Syndrome and Inflammatory Bowel Disease Overlap Syndrome, Pieces of the Puzzle Are Falling into Place." This was published in 2016, and it suggested that IBS is an early phase of IBD, and that they are at different evolutionary phases of the same disease, pointing to the fact that 39% of those with Crohn's disease also have IBS. So even though IBS and IBD are not exactly the same thing when we're talking about a moment in time, they are related to each other, and understanding the connection and how one can lead to the other influences our decisions in what do we eat, and also how do we address this in the long term to maybe prevent IBD from happening. Coming back to IBS as the origin, the possible beginning stages of a serious chronic condition, what are we looking at? Irritable bowel syndrome is a collection of symptoms which, if you have this, you are quite familiar with, no doubt, but perhaps you're listening and you're curious about what is going on here and you haven't experienced it yourself. These symptoms may include bloating and cramping, gas, diarrhea, constipation, sometimes both diarrhea and constipation, and these symptoms can be very intense. I've had clients who are frequently running for the bathroom or who have even memorized where the bathrooms are in all the public locations they visit. And sometimes they will spend an inordinate amount of time waiting to feel that they have completely evacuated their bowels before they can leave the bathroom. And that's obviously very embarrassing. It can be very painful and certainly inconvenient. There are three types of IBS as labeled by a hyphen and an additional letter after the acronym IBS. They are C for constipation, D for diarrhea, and A for alternating between the two. Dairy is a common trigger, but there can be other triggers implicated. Sometimes dairy doesn't actually cause these symptoms for people with IBS. Other common triggers include wheat, citrus fruits, fiber-rich foods, caffeine, alcohol, sugar, and even carbonated drinks can cause problems. Avoiding triggers can be the first step to help you avoid adding inflammation to the gut, but it's not going to solve the problem. We have to look at the cause of the IBS and herbs that support healing of the gut, which will help to increase your tolerance of triggers and may help to prevent long-term or serious problems like those of IBD. I like to emphasize that people with IBS are often sensitive to foods or have an intolerance, but are not usually allergic, meaning that if they can get the inflammation down, tone the mucosal lining, and moderate their intake of triggers, they can often significantly minimize symptoms so that it doesn't rule their life, and they may be able to reintroduce foods in moderation. If there was a true allergy, reintroducing foods would be a very bad idea. But for many people with IBS, it is possible to reintroduce them once a lot of gut work has been done. So what is the cause? If it isn't the triggers, what's happening here? There does seem to be a strong connection to genetics, which led to the University of Cambridge running a study of 50,000 people, which they published in 2021, and it showed a strong connection to genetics as suspected, but they suggested that it's not because maybe, you know, one person in the family had this condition and therefore I will too, but because we share genetic traits that create a conducive environment for similar conditions to develop. They're essentially DNA weaknesses that run in families. So when they are exposed to similar lifestyles or stressors, it's likely to produce similar results. It's the same reason that cancers, metabolic dysfunctions, and heart problems tend to be similar within families. It's not that someone develops a condition because someone else in their family had it, but rather that in similar conditions, they will both develop the same problems. IBS is not well understood, but there are a few factors that we know can cause it. One is not having a healthy microbiome. When we have too many unhealthy bacteria or not enough good bacteria in our digestive tracts, this can lead to many of the associated symptoms. And this can be caused by overuse of antibiotics, but also can just be from a really bad virus or bacterial infection that caused diarrhea for an extended period of time and really just knocked out the microbiome out of its balance. Another big connection is stomach acid imbalance. There is actually a huge connection here. More than half of those who are diagnosed with IBS have also been diagnosed with GERD as well, which is gastroesophageal reflux disease, or more often known as heartburn. IBS involves inflammation of the lower digestive tract, and GERD involves inflammation of the upper digestive tract. Basically, in these people, the whole thing from mouth to tail is swollen, sore, and sensitive. Unfortunately, many of the medications that are used to reduce symptoms of GERD and resulting stomach ulcers that can happen often lead to worsening IBS symptoms because they increase the permeability of the small and large intestines. That means that the walls of the intestinal tract literally start to come apart and little holes develop that allow proteins back into the bloodstream. And this is a recipe for disaster, and it's why many people with untreated IBS end up developing more and more food sensitivities over time. So what can we do about it, right? That's the whole goal in presenting this to you, is that we don't want to leave you without hope that you're going to have to deal with this forever. We want to know that there is hope that we can address this and make things better for ourselves. At this point, most people with IBS are told to avoid stress, which makes everything worse, avoid triggers, and maybe take enzymes to speed transit time and absorption. But what about the inflammation? Energetically, we see that the mucosal lining needs to be cooled down, toned up, and any holes and cracks healed, excess fluid moved out, and peristalsis, which is the movement of the muscle contractions, made functional again. And herbs can do a lot for this. I will say that pre and probiotic foods can be an important part of recalibrating the microbiome, especially if a virus or bacterial infection was the original trigger of inflammation. But sometimes you have to go really slow when introducing them, or it will just trigger symptoms, especially if you're prone to diarrhea. Supplements may be helpful, but again, this needs to be individualized to the person and not just a wholesale adoption of them. And probiotic foods can include things like sunchokes, dandelion root, chicory, garlic, onions, and asparagus. But if you do a Google search, you're going to find there are many probiotic and prebiotic foods out there. When addressing IBS with herbs, we want to make sure we're paying attention to the tissue state. If you are primarily constipated, that is a cold, depressed state that benefits from warming, stimulating carminatives. If you primarily have diarrhea, that's a hot, agitated state that would benefit from relaxing and cooling herbs. Alternating forms of IBS often involve spasming muscle contractions that would benefit from magnesium-rich plants that regulate muscle contractions. And of course, there is inflammation of the upper digestive system. Bitters and emulsions will often be supportive there. In addition to balancing the tissue state, we can safely assume that anti-inflammatory and wound healing or vulnerary herbs that have an affinity for mucosal tissue are also going to be helpful. Let's talk about some of my favorite herbs for these purposes. For cooling and calming down and restoring mucosal tissue, I like to work with burdock, hibiscus, meadowsweet, milk thistle, astragalus, barberry, slippery elm, marshmallow, and plantain. And then there are a whole bunch of others that I also will draw from that have different characteristics I might like, such as being a nervine or nutritive or otherwise fitting the person's tissue state. And those might include things like dandelion root, yellow dock, cat's claw, skullcap, chamomile. Chamomile is especially helpful for chronic diarrhea, where everything is just like, everything's draining in a downward way. Lobelia, lemon, St. John's wort, plantain, I think I already mentioned that one, aloe, elderberry, horehound, borage, lavender, cinquefoil, mullein, valerian, rose, raspberry, wild lettuce, peach leaf, and blackberry leaf. All of these are very cooling and calming, and are many of them have a demulcent property that's just going to be really supportive to mucosal tissue. But then if we have maybe constipation, we want to work with more warming and stimulating herbs that are still going to focus on restoring mucosal tissue and especially on restoring normal peristalsis. So oftentimes what we see with IBS is that the muscle contractions are not, the muscles are not working as a team. So you have certain parts of the digestive system where the muscles are contracting rapidly or very tightly, and then other parts which are more relaxed, they're more loose. And so the muscles are really fighting against each other. Restoring peristalsis means that we're getting the whole thing functioning correctly. We're getting the whole muscular tube working in a rhythmic fashion. And there are certain herbs that help to promote that process. So these warming and stimulating and restoring herbs include turmeric, black pepper, ginger, fennel, cinnamon, cardamom, chamomile, ginger, prickly ash, barberry, Queen Anne's lace, calendula, sage, thyme, oregano, colt's foot, and the last one I put on here is mugwort, which has been shown on blood tests to reduce food sensitivity, which is very interesting. Some of these herbs, especially marshmallow, slippery elm, cinnamon, and calendula, can provide a lot of relief to those with heartburn as well. And so keeping in mind what's going on in the rest of the body, if there are upper digestive symptoms, you want to choose herbs from these lists that are also going to address those so that you're not having to create a huge recipe, but rather choosing a select few herbs that are going to be best suited to you and your needs. And a cold infusion of any of these can be so soothing to irritated esophageal tissue. In fact, if you're trying to calm down the lower digestive tract, a cold infusion may work best anyway. You can try hot and cold to see what helps you to feel best, but the reason that a cold infusion can be very soothing is because when you prepare a hot tea with a demulsin herb, you will evaporate off many of the properties of the plant that have that demulcency to them, that have that soothing, cooling property. And we obviously don't want to evaporate that, so we work with a longer infusion process with cooler water. Two herbs in particular, which are highly accessible and work well for all types of IBS, including bloating, spasms, diarrhea, and constipation, are basil and chamomile. So these are the two herbs that I often recommend first, unless the person also has heartburn and other concerning symptoms. Basil and chamomile are at the top of my list. They are so accessible, so easy to find. They're generally very affordable and universal. So they're pretty safe to work with for most people. And I recommend taking a few sips of one of these teas either before your main meal of the day and then finish the cup after you've eaten, or you can take a few drops of tincture prior to meals to aid in digestion, or you can take a few drops of tincture after your meals if needed to help relieve symptoms. Coincidentally, I chose basil for my herb focus for today. Basil is known in Latin as Osimum basilicum, and it is a member of the mint family. And in addition to being a stimulant to the digestive system, it has lots of other benefits. It is carminative, it is a relaxing nervine, and it's also relaxing to the muscles because it is rich in magnesium, but it's also antibacterial, antifungal, antidepressant, anti-inflammatory. It is diaphoretic, diuretic, antiseptic, anesthetic, antispasmodic, which does come in handy for those muscles. It is anthelmintic, and it is sedative. It is cultivated around the world, and it can be harvested from the time that the leaves begin to show until after it blooms. Although the time to gather the leaves for the highest medicinal property would be right up until the flower buds begin to develop. Its leaves are primarily what we use for culinary purposes usually, and it goes well with other Mediterranean herbs like oregano, thyme, and rosemary, and it also goes well with other mints because it's in the mint family, and citruses also go well with mint family plants. Basil has a warming, spicy and sweet, and a little bit of a bitter flavor. And of course, there are many different varieties of basil, and the precise flavor will depend on the variation. But across the board, it is generally regarded as safe for most people, especially in culinary doses. And those who are pregnant should stick to culinary doses and avoid higher ones. Notice that I said in the actions that basil is anthelmintic, and that means it kills worms. Any plant that kills worms should be avoided in high doses during pregnancy because it may trigger a miscarriage. There are lots of ways that basil can be supportive, not just to IBS and reducing diarrhea and constipation, the stomach cramps and gas that we talked about, but it also helps to prevent heartburn. It helps to reduce headaches. Many of the mint family plants do that. It also helps with reducing anxiety and really just overstimulated nerves in general. One of the signs that I look for is what's going on with the tongue. And if the tongue is shaking or quivering, basil can help with that. Again, you're looking at that high magnesium content that's really going to help settle down any kind of overstimulation of the nerves and muscles. Basil is also very cleansing to the skin, so it can support the skin in restoring health. If there are any kinds of rashes or imbalances topically, it smells bad to bugs, so we can use it as an insect repellent, especially the essential oil, which can be sprayed directly onto clothes or onto the skin without fear of harm. Basil is great for the kidneys. It helps to reduce spasmodic coughs in the same way that it helps with spasms of muscles. It's helping with the diaphragm. Again, it helps with reducing parasites or worms. It can reduce joint pain. It is cooling to the body because it helps to open up the skin so that we're able to sweat off more easily. So it can help to reduce fevers. It helps to regulate blood sugar. It can help to fight against ear infections. Again, you can use the essential oil in this way and dilute it and dab a little behind the ear if there is an ear infection. It can help to bring on a delayed menstrual cycle. And of course, it has all of these wonderful digestive benefits and it tastes great. Okay, I really appreciate you guys all being here today. Thank you for listening to today's episode. If you found it helpful, please share it with a loved one that you think it would bless. And if you would like assistance creating a wellness plan for yourself, please visit www.laureltreewellnessllc.com. I hope you have a fantastic week, and I will see you all again very soon. Bye.
The Family Herbalism Podcast is created for educational purposes only. You are responsible for any and all medical and health decisions you choose to make. If you experience a medical emergency, please contact appropriate medical providers. To receive herbalist support, please visit www.laureltreewellnessllc.com. If you enjoy this podcast and find it helpful, please share it with your friends and family. Thank you for listening.